Chapter 5. Because the game of hide-and-seek was still going on, it took Edmund and Lucy some time to find the others. But when they at last were all together, which happened in the long room where the suit of armor was, Lucy burst out, "Peter, Susan, it's all true. Edmund has seen it too. There is a country you can get to through the wardrobe. Edmund and I both got in. We met one another in the wood. Go on, Edmund. Tell them all about it."
"What's all this about, Ed?" Peter asked.
And now we come to one of the nastiest things in this story. Up to that moment, Edmund had been feeling sick and sulky and annoyed with Lucy for being right. But he hadn't made up his mind as to what to do. When Peter suddenly asked him the question, he decided all at once to do the meanest and most spiteful thing he could think of. He decided to let Lucy down.
"Tell us, Ed," Susan asked.
And Edmund gave a very superior look, as if he were far older than Lucy. There was really only a year's difference between them. And then a little snigger, and he said,
"Oh, yes, Lucy and I have been playing, pretending that all her story about a country in the wardrobe is true. Just for fun, of course. There's nothing really there."
Poor Lucy gave Edmund one look and rushed out of the room. Edmund, who was becoming a nastier person every minute, thought he had scored a great success, and went on at once to say, "There she goes again. What's the matter with her? That's the worst of young kids. They always..."
"Now look here," said Peter, turning to him savagely, "shut up. You've been perfectly beastly to Lou ever since she started this nonsense about the wardrobe, and now you go on playing games with her about it and sending her off again. I believe you did it simply out of spite."
"But it's all nonsense," said Edmund, very taken back.
"Of course it's all nonsense," said Peter. "That's just the point. Lou was perfectly all right when we left home. But since we've been down here, she seems to be either going queer in the head or else turning into a most frightful liar. But whatever it is, what good do you think you'll be doing by jeering and nagging her one day and encouraging her the next?"
I thought, said Edmund, but he really couldn't think of anything at all to say.
"You don't think at all, do you?" said Peter. "It's just spite. You've always liked being beastly to anyone smaller than yourself. We've seen that at school before now."
"Oh, do stop it," said Susan. "It won't make things any better having a row between you two. Let's go and find Lucy." It was not surprising that when they found Lucy a good deal later, everyone could see that she had been crying. Nothing they could say would make any difference to her. She stuck to her story and then said,
"I don't care what you think. I don't care what you say. You can tell the professor, or you can write to Mother, or you can do anything you like. I know I've met a fawn in there, and I wish I'd stayed there and you were all beasts. Beasts." It was a very unpleasant evening. Lucy was miserable, and Edmund was beginning to feel that his plan wasn't working as well as he had expected. The two older ones were really beginning to think that Lucy was out of her mind. They stood in the passage talking about it in whispers long after she had gone to bed. The result was, the next morning, they decided that they really would go and tell the whole thing to the professor. "He'll write to Father if he thinks there is really something wrong with Lou," said Peter. "It's getting beyond us." So they went and knocked on the study door, and the professor said, "Come in," and got up and found chairs for them and said he was quite at their disposal. Then he sat listening to them with the tips of his fingers pressed together, never interrupting them till they had finished the whole story. After that, he said nothing for quite a long time. Finally, he cleared his throat and said the last thing either of them expected. "How do you know," he said, "that your sister's story is not true?" But, Susan began and then stopped. Anyone could see from the old man's face that he was perfectly serious. Then Susan pulled herself together and said,
"But Edmund said they had only been pretending."
"That is a point," said the professor, "which certainly deserves consideration. Very careful consideration. For example, if you'll excuse me for asking the question, does your experience lead you to regard your brother or your sister as the more reliable? I mean, which is the more truthful?"
"That's just the funny thing about it, sir," said Peter. "Up till now, I'd have to say Lucy every time."
"And what do you think, my dear?" said the professor, turning to Susan.
"Well," said Susan in general, "I'd say the same thing as Peter. But this couldn't be true. All this about a wood and a fawn."
"That is more than I know," said the professor. "And the charge of lying against someone whom you've always found truthful is a very serious thing. A very serious thing indeed."
"We were afraid it mightn't have been lying," said Susan. "We thought there might be something wrong with Lucy."
"Madness, you mean," said the professor quite coolly.
"Oh, you can make your minds easy about that one. One has only to look at her and talk to her to know that she is not mad."
"But then," said Susan, and she stopped.
She had never dreamed that a grown-up would talk like the professor, and really didn't know what to think.
"Logic," said the professor, half to himself. "Why don't they teach logic at these schools? There are only three possibilities. Either your sister is telling lies, that she is mad, or that she's telling the truth. You know she doesn't tell lies, and it is obvious that she has not gone mad. For the moment, then, unless any further evidence turns up, we must assume that she is telling the truth."
Susan looked at him very hard and was quite sure from the expression on his face that he was not making fun of them at all.
"But how could that be true, sir?" Peter asked.
"Why do you say that?" asked the professor.
"Well, for one thing," said Peter, if it was real, why doesn't everyone find the country every time they go into the wardrobe? I mean, there was nothing there when we looked. Even Lucy didn't pretend there was."
"What has that to do with it?" the professor asked.
"Well, sir, if things are real, they're there all the time."
"Are they?" asked the professor.
And Peter did not know quite what to say.
But there was no time," said Susan. "Lucy had no time to have gone anywhere, even if there was such a place. She came running after us the very moment we were out of the room. It was less than a minute, and she pretended to have been away for hours."
"That's the very thing that makes her story so very likely to be true," said the professor.
"If there really is a door in this house that leads to some other world, and I should warn you that this is a very strange house, and even I know very little about it, if, I say, she had gone to another world, I should not be at all surprised to find that the other world has a separate time of its own, so that however long you stayed there, it would never take up any of our time. On the other hand, I don't think many girls her age would invent that idea for themselves. If she had been pretending, she would have hidden for a reasonable time before coming out and telling her story."
"Do you really mean, sir," said Peter, "that there could be other worlds all over the place, just around the corner, like that?"
"Nothing is more probable," said the professor, taking off his spectacles and beginning to polish them while he muttered to himself,
"I wonder what they do teach at these schools."
"But what are we to do?" said Susan. She felt that the conversation was beginning to get off point.
"My dear young lady," said the professor, suddenly looking up with a very sharp expression at both of them, "there is one plan which no one has yet suggested, and which is well worth trying."
"What is it?" asked Susan.
"We might all try minding our own business," he said. And that was the end of that conversation. After things were a good deal better for Lucy. Peter saw to it that Edmund stopped jeering at her, and neither she nor anyone else felt inclined to talk about the wardrobe at all. It had become a rather alarming subject, and so for the time it looked as if all the adventures were coming to an end. But that was not to be true. This house of the professor's, which even he knew so little about, was so old and famous that people from all over England used to come and ask permission to see over it. It was the sort of house that is mentioned in guidebooks and even in histories, and while it might be for all manner of stories were told about it, some of them even stranger than the one I'm telling you now. And when parties of sightseers arrived and asked to see the house, the professor always gave them permission, and Mrs. MacCready, the housekeeper, showed them around, telling them about the pictures and the armor and the rare books in the library. Mrs. MacCready was not at all fond of children, and did not like to be interrupted when she was telling visitors all the things she knew. She had said to Susan and Peter almost on the first morning, along with a good many other instructions, "And please remember you're to keep out of the way whenever I'm taking a party over the house."
just as if any of us would want to waste half the morning trailing around a crowd of strange grown-ups, said Edmund, and the other three thought the same. That was how the adventures began for the second time. A few mornings after, Peter and Edmund were looking at the suit of armor and wondering if they could take it to bits when the two girls rushed into the room and said, "Look out! Here comes the MacCready and a whole gang with her!" Sharp's the words to Peter, and all four made off through the door at the far end of the room. But when they had got out into the green room and beyond it into the library, they suddenly heard voices ahead of them and realized that Mrs. MacCready must be bringing the party of sightseers up the back stairs instead of up the front stairs as they had expected. And after that, whether it was that they lost their heads or that Mrs. MacCready was trying to catch them or that some magic in the house had come to life and was chasing them into Narnia, they seemed to find themselves being followed everywhere until at last Susan said, "Oh, bother those trippers here, and let's go into the wardrobe room until they've passed. No one will follow us in there." But the moment they were inside, they heard voices in the passage, and then someone fumbling at the door. And then they all saw the handle start to turn. "Quick," said Peter, "there's nowhere else," and flung open the wardrobe. All four of them bundled inside it and sat there, panting in the dark. Peter held the door closed, but did not shut it, for, of course, he remembered that, as every sensible person does, that you should never shut yourself in a wardrobe. Chapter 6. "I wish the MacCready would hurry up and take all those people away," said Susan presently. "I'm getting horribly cramped." "And what a filthy smell of camphor," said Edmund. "I expect the pockets of these coats are filled with it," said Susan, "to keep away the moths." "There's something sticking into my back," said Peter. "And isn't it cold?" Susan observed. "Now that you mention it, it is cold," Peter said. "And hang it all, it's wet, too. What's the matter with this place? I'm sitting in something wet, and it's getting wetter every minute." He struggled to his feet. "Oh, let's get out," said Edmund. "They've gone." "Oh," says Susan suddenly, and everyone asked her what was the matter. "I'm sitting against a tree," said Susan. "And look, it's getting light over there." "By Jove, you're right," said Peter. "And look there, and there. It's trees all around. And this wet stuff is snow. Why, I do believe we've gotten to Lucy's wood after all." And now there was no mistaking it, and all four children stood blinking in the daylight of a winter day. Behind them were coats hanging on pegs. In front of them were snow-covered trees. Peter turned at once to Lucy. "I apologize for not believing you," he said. "I'm sorry. Will you shake hands?" "Oh, of course," said Lucy, and she did. "And now," said Susan, "what do we do next?" "Do?" Peter said. "Why, go and explore the wood, of course." "Ugh," said Susan, stomping her feet. "It's pretty cold. What about putting on some of these coats?" "They're not ours," said Peter doubtfully. "I'm sure nobody would mind," said Susan. "It isn't as if we wanted to take them out of the house. We shan't take them even out of the wardrobe." "Oh, I never thought of that, Sue," said Peter. "Of course, now that you put it that way, I see. No one could say that you bagged a coat as long as you leave it in the wardrobe where you found it. And I suppose this whole country is technically in the wardrobe." They immediately carried out Susan's very sensible plan. The coats were rather too big for them, so they came down to their heels and looked more like royal robes than coats when they put them on. But they all felt a good deal warmer, and each thought of the others looked better in their new get-ups and more suitable in the landscape. "We can pretend we are Arctic explorers," said Lucy. "This is going to be exciting enough without pretending," said Peter, as he began leading the way forward into the forest. There were heavy, darkish clouds overhead, and it looked as if there might be more snow before night. "I say," began Edmund presently, "oughtn't we be bearing a bit more to the left? That is, if we are aiming for the lamppost." He had forgotten for the moment that he must pretend he never made it to the wood before. The moment the words came out of his mouth, though, he realized he had given himself away. Everyone stopped and stared at him. Peter whistled. "So you really were here," he said, "that time Lucy said she'd met you in here, and you made out that she was telling lies." There was dead silence for a moment. "Well, of all the poisonous little beasts," said Peter, and shrugged his shoulders and said no more. There seemed, indeed, no more to say, and presently the four resumed their journey.
But Edmund was saying to himself, "I'll pay you for this, you pack of stuck-up, self-satisfied prigs." "Where are we going anyway?" Susan asked, chiefly for the sake of changing the subject. "I think Lou ought to be the leader," said Peter. "Goodness knows she deserves it. Where will you take us, Lou?" "What about going to see Mr. Tumnus?" Lucy offered. "He's the nice one I told you about." Everyone agreed to this, and off they went, walking briskly and stamping their feet. Lucy proved to be a good leader. At first, she wondered whether she would be able to find the way, but she recognized an odd-looking tree in one place and a stump in another, and brought them to where the ground became uneven and into the little valley that, and at the last, to the very door of Mr. Tumnus's cave. But they were terribly surprised when they got there. The door had been wrenched off its hinges and broken into bits. Inside, the cave was dark and cold and had the damp feel and smell of a place that had not been lived in for several days. Snow had drifted in from the doorway and was heaped on the floor, mixed with something black, which turned out to be the charred sticks and ashes from the fire. Someone had apparently flung it all about the room and then stamped it out. The crockery lay smashed on the floor, and the picture of the Faun's father had been slashed into shreds with a knife. "This is a pretty good washout," said Edmund. "Not much good coming here." "What was this?" Peter asked, stooping down. He had just noticed a piece of paper, which had been nailed through the carpet of the floor. Is there something written on it?" Susan asked. "Yes, why?" "Yes, there is," Peter said. "But I can't read it in this light. Let's go out into the open air." They all went out into the daylight and crowded around Peter as he read the following words. "The former occupant of these premises, the Faun Tumnus, is under arrest and awaiting his trial on the charge of high treason against Her Imperial Majesty Jadis, Queen of Narnia, Chantilene of Cair Paravel, Empress of the Lone Islands, etc. Also for comforting her and her said Majesty's enemies, harboring spies, and fraternizing with humans. Signed, Margrim, Captain of the Secret Police. Long live the Queen." The children stared at each other. "I don't know that I'm going to like this place after all," Susan said. "Who is this Queen Lou?" said Peter. "Do you know anything about her?" "She isn't a real queen at all," answered Lucy. "She's a horrible witch, the White Witch. Everyone, all the wood people, they hate her. She has made an enchantment over the whole country so that it's always winter here and never Christmas. I wonder if there's any point going on," Susan said. "I mean, it doesn't seem particularly safe here, and it looks as if it won't be much fun either. And it's getting colder by the minute. We've brought nothing to eat. What about we just go home?" "Oh, but we can't, said Lucy suddenly. "Don't you see? We can't just go home, not after this. It is all on my account that the poor Faun has gotten into this trouble. He hid me from the witch and showed me the way back. That's what it means by comforting the witch's enemies and fraternizing with humans. We must simply try to rescue him." "A lot we could do," said Edmund. "We haven't even got anything to eat." "Oh, shut up, you," said Peter, who was still very angry with Edmund. "What do you think, Susan?" "Oh, I have a horrible feeling that Lou is right," said Susan. "I don't want to go a step further, and I wish we'd never come. But I think we must try to do something for Mr. Whatever his name is. I mean, the Faun."
"That's what I feel too," said Peter. "I'm worried about having no food with us. I'd vote for going back and getting something from the larder. Only there doesn't seem to be any certainty of getting into this country again when once we've got out of it. I think we'll have to go on." Both girls answered with a "so do I." "If only we knew where the poor chap was imprisoned," said Peter. They were all still wondering what to do next when Lucy said, "Look, there's a robin with such a red breast. It's the first bird I've seen here. I say, I wonder, can birds talk in Narnia? It almost looks as if it has wanted to say something to us." Then she turned to the robin and said, "Please, can you tell us where Tumnus the Faun has been taken to?" And as she said this, she took a step towards the bird. It at once flew away, but only as far as the next tree, where it perched and looked at them very hard, as if it understood all that they had been saying. Almost without noticing that they had done before, the four children went a step or two nearer to it. At this, the robin flew away again to the next tree, and once more looked very hard at them. You couldn't have found a robin with a redder chest or a brighter eye. "Do you know," said Lucy, "I really believe he means for us to follow him."
"I have an idea that he does," said Susan.
"What do you think, Peter?"
We might try and do it," answered Peter.
The robin appeared to understand the matter thoroughly. It kept going from tree to tree, always a few yards ahead of them, but always so near that they could easily follow it. In this way, it led them on slightly downhill. Whenever the robin alighted, a little shower of snow would fall off the branch. Presently, the clouds parted overhead, and the winter sun came out, and the snow all around them grew dazzlingly bright. They had been traveling this way for about half an hour, with the two girls in front, when Edmund said to Peter, "If you're not still too high and mighty to talk to me, I have something to say which you'd better listen to."
"What is it?" asked Peter.
"Shh, not so loud," said Edmund. "There's no good frightening the girls. But have you realized what we're doing?"
"What?"
Peter asked, lowering his voice to a whisper. "We're following a guide we know nothing about. How do we know which side that bird is on? Why shouldn't it be leading us into a trap?"
"That's a nasty idea. Still, a robin, you know. There are good birds in the stories, at least all the ones that I've read.
I'm sure a robin wouldn't be on the wrong side."
"If it comes to that, which is the right side? How do we know that the fawns are on the right side and the queen, yes, I know, we've been told she's a witch, is on the wrong?
We don't really know anything about either side."
"But the fawn saved Lucy."
"He said he did. But how do we know?
And that's another thing, too. Has anyone the least idea of the way to get home from here?"
"Great Scott," said Peter. "I hadn't even thought of that. And now there's no chance of dinner, either."